outcast would be enough to keep me up, as well as my terrible snoring and overall unattractive sleeping style. Ever since I was a young girl, I've snored and drooled and slept with my mouth wide open. It wasn't pretty, and at 11, pretty can be important. At sleepovers, I would often be the last girl standing. Everybody would fall asleep while I stared at the ceiling. Sometimes I would tiptoe around and watch everyone sleep. After tossing and turning, I would lightly snoop around and then put on my coat and sneak outside. I watched more than one sunrise in a strange suburban driveway. Then I would sleep late and wake to an empty house and a mother who would reluctantly mix up a new batch of pancakes. My first period class in high school started at 7:30 a.m. We lived in a ranch house with two bathrooms, and my mom taught special ed at our high school, so Mom, Greg, and I would be angling for the shower at the same time. I would snooze until the last possible second and then rush to get ready. My hair would still be wet and often frozen by the time I walked from my house to the car of whatever friend was driving me to school. I never rode with my mom. I generally preferred to ride with Rob, who played his U2 cassettes and wore acid-wash jeans. I would fight sleep in my first couple of classes until lunch came at 10:20 a.m., when I would eat the 10,000 calories given to every American teenager. I would get home from school at 1:45 and crash hard on the couch, waking up only to watch my beloved General Hospital or to do homework or sluggishly walk to softball practice. I was always tired. I am always tired. I now read articles about how great sleep is and how important it is, and I cry because I want it so bad, and I'm so mad at how great everyone else seems to be at it. I got some relief from my sleep problem once I started working at SNL. This sounds crazy, I realize that. It was truly a vampire life and one that suited my internal clock. At the time, I did not have children, so I was able to stay up very late and sleep very late. I remember 10 a.m. feeling incredibly early and 3 a.m. being my usual bedtime. This was my life for 7 years. New York City is the perfect place to be awake in the middle of the night. I would rub shoulders with nurses and truck drivers. I would watch newspapers being delivered and workout maniacs getting in the first runs of the day. I would watch wired rich kids stumble out of clubs and old Italian men water down the sidewalks. Being awake and sober at 4 a.m. is a much different experience from being wasted and stumbling home. I've certainly done both. I remember a particularly awful night when I went to a club and stayed out all night, only to have to shoot a commercial parody the next morning. I was tired and wired as I shivered in a freezing trailer getting a spray tan to look like Fergie. The host that week was John Heater, and we were supposed to be playing the Black Eyed Peas. We had to dance in the middle of a New Jersey highway at 6 a.m. I think John was the only one who had slept the previous night. Kenan Thompson kept pretending to take calls from himself, asking why he had done this to himself. It was a long day. But nothing during my SNL years prepared me for children. The thing about little babies is that you're always afraid they're going to die. I mean, at least in the beginning. You're constantly checking to make sure they didn't die and you haven't killed them. Because of this, it's truly impossible to sleep when you are a new mother. The other thing about little babies is that you don't get the weekends off. You don't get a Saturday where you can catch up. The sleep deprivation after children is so real. I liken it to what it must feel like to walk on the moon and to cry the whole time because you had heard that the moon was supposed to be great, but in truth, it totally sucks. I started working on Parks and Recreation when my first child was 3 months old, and I can remember a few times when I fell asleep standing up with my eyes open. I slept wherever I could, 20 minutes at lunch, during production meetings, in my car. I remember being filled with rage when childless people would talk about brunch. I had my second son, Abel, and aged 100 years in his first year. I had a hard time getting my body back after baby number two. The good news was I got to do it on camera. I am still excellent at sleeping in places that aren't my bed. I can sleep on an airplane like a boss. Sometimes I look forward to travel for just that reason. My children forced me to realize the true value of sleep and made me want to conquer my inability to get any. I try to believe what Annie from Annie says when she reminds us that tomorrow is only a day away. Sleep can completely change your entire outlook on life. One good night's sleep can help you realize that you shouldn't break up with someone, or you're being too hard on your friend, or you actually will win the race or the game or get the job. Sleep helps you win at life. So, at the ripe old age of 40, I decided to go to a sleep center and see if I could get better at sleep. I was spending a lot of time in Beverly Hills, which is the strangest place in the world, and it's also the capital of doctors. If you've never been to a doctor's office in Beverly Hills, you haven't lived. Every single waiting room looks like a gorgeous apartment owned by a Persian billionaire. I rolled up to a fancy sleep center at the assigned 10 p.m. call time. I had spent the entire day not drinking caffeine, as instructed. I'm a tea girl. Coffee smells so good, but my stomach doesn't really like it. Tea is what my mom and I would drink together in the afternoon, and what Archie and I sometimes sip when we want to have serious talks. I abstained from tea, too, yet was still worried about my chances of falling asleep. I knew I was going to be hooked up to wires so they could record my snoring and check me for sleep apnea, and I seriously doubted I would be able to go down. I wondered out loud if anyone had ever stayed up all night. The sweet and gentle technician shook his head no. He asked me why I was sent to him, and I tilted my head and in a very flirty way said to him, "I don't know, I'm told I snore." What I should have said was, "Throughout my life, I've been told I snore so loudly that it sounds like I'm dying or choking. I come from a family of snorers, and we all used to record each other to show each other the damning evidence. I'm convinced my body is trying to gently strangle me to death." I was led into a small room that looked like the weirdest Holiday Inn you have ever seen. A bed and a lamp did not distract from the multiple pulleys, wires, clips, and clamps. I was hooked up like a puppet while I continued to make small talk with the technician. He had a terrific bedside manner, which is extremely important when you are the only man on duty in a weird sleeping center. I cracked bad, dirty jokes as he hooked me up with electrodes. I sheepishly asked him about his kids as he showed me a crazy breathing machine he would try out on me later. He turned off the light and shut the door, and I laughed out loud. "There is no way I can sleep here," I thought. And then I fell asleep, eventually. The rest was all weird memories of being nudged, hooked up again, and turned over. I was gently woken up 8 hours later and felt like shit, which was disappointing. I think I had expected to feel terrific, or at least pleasantly buffed and shined. He told me the doctor would read my results and come speak to me. I asked him if I had snored. He gently nodded and said, "A little." The doctor sat me down in front of a neon green graph showing my sleep pattern. Even to the untrained eye, it didn't look good. It looked like a bad polygraph. It looked like I had been constantly lying to someone as I slept. He asked me how many times a night I thought I woke up. 4, I said. "Sometimes 5. He told me I woke myself up 20 to 30 times a night. I had mild to moderate sleep apnea, and I was only reaching REM sleep for a few minutes at a time over the course of a few hours. I nodded my head. This just confirmed what I had always known. I was a bad sleeper. In some ways, I was disappointed. I had hoped he would pull me aside and say, "You are the worst case I've ever seen. It's a miracle you do all that you do. I am sending you to a Hawaiian sleep rehab immediately." Instead, I was handed a CPAP machine, which stands for Compression Something Amy Poehler. I don't know. I'm sorry. I wasn't listening. I just stared at this crazy mask and accompanying gurgling device next to it, and I just couldn't wait for the instructions to be over. I looked at it the same way you look at a plate of vegetables. You know it's good for you, but most of the time you don't feel like it. I have a boyfriend who knows how to settle me. He puts his hand on my chest and he tells me boring stories. He promises me we can stay up as late as I want. On one of our first nights together, I woke up apologizing for my snoring, and he pulled out the 2 earplugs he had worn to bed so he could hear what I was saying. It was one of the most romantic gestures I have ever seen. I know I should wear my crazy breathing machine, but I just can't pull the trigger. I wore it religiously for a short time and then stuck it in my closet to gather dust. I know I should use it. I'm working on it. I'm a bad sleeper, I told you. Until I commit to the machine, I will try strips and mouth guards and special pillows. I want to sleep. I do. I want to go gentle into that good night. So help me God.
Symmetry is pleasing, but not as sexy. Einstein is cool, but Picasso knows what I'm talking about.
Part 3. Be whoever you are. How I fell in love with improv, New York. I held a microphone at Luna Lounge and repeated instructions to the audience. It was a warm summer night in 1997, and the New York street sounds bled through the doors and onto the stage. I was 26 years old and supporting myself doing comedy. The UCB was guest hosting a Monday evening show, and the audience was stoned and happy. They were happy because they had just seen great comedy with young talent. The State, Marc Maron, Janine Garofalo, Zach Galifianakis, Louis C.K., John Benjamin, John Glazer, Sarah Silverman. They were stoned because we had brought weed for the entire audience and bullied people into getting high. We handed out joints and coaxed people into digging their own one-hitters out of their backpacks. Being asked to host a Luna Lounge show was a big deal. We had worked hard on our introductions and bits in between guests, which included handing out weed and potato chips. This was a pre-9/11 New York, where no one had yet heard the words Homeland Security. But it was also a Mayor Giuliani New York, where there was artistic pushback against the feeling that our rights were being slowly limited each day. I had arrived in Manhattan in April 1996, a few months after a major blizzard that forced residents to ski down Fifth Avenue. We had come out to New York once to do a showcase while we were still living in Chicago and performed at a cabaret bar in the West Village called The Duplex. I don't remember if anyone was in the audience, but the proprietor was not too thrilled with this loud Midwestern sketch group and their giant bag of props. More than once we were told, "This is not Chicago!" Besser and I found a street-level studio apartment listed in the Village Voice on the corner of Bleecker and 10th Street. The West Village still had a tiny bit of edge, and our studio apartment was sandwiched between a store called Condomania and Kim's Video, a hipster record outlet that was notorious for its slow and grouchy employees. The apartment had bars on the windows and looked out onto garbage, and when we first arrived, there were 20 people in line to rent it. We hustled to meet the horrible landlord and called our parents to co-sign from his cluttered and disgusting office. I have a vague memory of this millionaire slumlord standing up behind his mess of a desk and saying, "Let me take a look at you." I may have even spun around for him. Each evening, Matt and I would roll our change and throw pennies at the rats outside our windows. We put bowls over our stove at night so the mice wouldn't come up through the burners. Once, I pulled back the curtain and locked eyes with the masturbating peeping Tom, and he just waved at me like someone saying farewell from the deck of a ship. It was the closest I had ever felt to Patti Smith. I loved it. Much of our first year in the city was spent lugging props. New York was great for purchasing last-minute dildos, nitrous, and cap guns. UCB shows had evolved into a mix of sketch and improvisation, and we would roll out giant monitors to play our videotaped bits. This was before you could check out a person's entire career on YouTube. Important people had to come to see you live, and we would wait for network executives to show up, masking tape over their seats, waiting for Guffman style. We came to town with two shows we had already been performing in Chicago, humbly titled Millennium Approaches and Perestroika. These shows were made up of sketches and videos and improv. I was playing Girl Scouts and old men and everything in between. The four of us, me and Ian and Besser and Walsh, performed sketch at black box theaters like KGB Bar and Tribeca Lab. And after paying a rental fee and buying props, we lost money on every show. Most of those early shows had an audience of 10. 5 nice friends, 2 strangers, 1 crazy person, and a set of parents. We started doing open mic nights at places like Surf Reality and Luna Lounge, where we met other performers like us. We would spend the day wearing giant cat heads or dinosaur masks, harassing people with bullhorns in Washington Square Park, and handing out flyers to our show. We spent the nights performing and writing and dreaming and scheming. It was sketch and improv 24/7. We had no one to take care of but ourselves. It was an interesting time to be doing comedy. Stand-ups had ruled the 80s, with some of them, like Roseanne Barr and Jerry Seinfeld, parlaying their success into eponymous television shows. The 90s were still a time when comedy could make you big bucks if a network wanted to give you a development deal. But that was for the select few. For the rest of us, there was a movement happening in New York and L.A., a wave some were calling alternative comedy. To some, we seemed like a bunch of green apple performers reading half-baked ideas out of notebooks. But we knew it was something else. People were trying things out on stage and mixing everything together in an exciting soup. Stand-ups were incorporating music, performance artists told jokes, musicians wrote sketches. Small theaters were offering alternative nights, and audiences were treated to performers who were totally different yet tonally compatible. Anything seemed possible. Michael Portnoy, a.k.a. Soybomb, would contort his body to music, and then Sarah Vowell would read a story, and then Dave Chappelle would tell jokes. It felt like a language I understood and comedy I could participate in. My improvisational training had prepared me for this. I met Janeane Garofalo at a book club with Andy Richter's wife, Sarah Thayer. I love Janine's stand-up and her work on The Ben Stiller Show and in Reality Bites, and we would walk all over New York and talk about life and art and politics. I would fight the urge to call her my idol, and slowly we became close friends. Being in New York felt alive and weird and new. "The show is not over," I shouted into the microphone to the young and buzzed Luna Lounge crowd. We announced that we were all going to head across the street for the finale. Once again, the UCB was taking the audience outside. Cynthia True, our good friend and a comedy writer for Time Out New York, was going to stage an event. She would be walking down the street naked in an attempt to raise money and protest her rent increase. What had started as a gentle dare was now going to be a Lower East Side happening. We spilled out onto the sidewalk, and I raced around the corner to help Cynthia prepare for her bold strut. In those first few years in New York, we had been lucky. Our second year in the city, we found a small dance studio called Solo Arts, and we made it our de facto home. It was a 5-story walk-up with a wonky floor, and my brother Greg served as our bartender. We programmed shows 5 nights a week and taught classes to pay the rent. At night, we drew crowds with our free show, Ass Cat, a completely improvised show where we would get an audience suggestion that would inspire a monologist to tell a story, and then we would improvise off of those stories. The title Ass Cat comes from a scene where Horatio and Besser and McKay and others were bombing so badly that they started loudly saying, "Ass Cat! Ass Cat! Ass Cat!" in a sing-songy voice. The word represented a giant fuck-around, a night where anything goes. We did 2 shows every Sunday. It was the closest thing I had to church. We supported ourselves with odd jobs and writing gigs. Conan O'Brien's show was speaking to a massive and young audience, and he would put us in weekly bits on late night. If you said more than 6 lines on air, you made $600, and comedy pieces like Staring Contest helped me pay my rent. I once spent hours running around a hot track wearing the giant foam rubber Andy costume. Nipsey Russell was there that day and told me, "Hollywood has 1 typewriter and 1,000 copy machines." I nodded my sweaty head as if I understood what he meant. Brian Stack, a former Chicago improviser and writer for Conan, wrote a character for me called Andy's little sister. Her name was Stacy, and she wore headgear and was obsessed with Conan. I would sit in my tiny dressing room and memorize long monologues that often ended with my tackling Conan at his desk. It was another character to add to my repertoire of adolescent lisping maniacs. Adam Sandler and Rob Schneider saw the bit while they were visiting and cast me in the film Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo. I was paid the basic daily rate the day I showed up on set the summer of 1998. My first shot was with thousands of extras in Anaheim Stadium. It was my first big Hollywood movie, but not the first time I had been on film. My film debut was Tomorrow Night, a 1998 New York indie from an up-and-coming auteur named Louis C.K. I played Woman Sprayed with Hose. Soon after, the States' Michael Showalter and David Wayne would cast me in their cult classic Wet Hot American Summer, a film whose behind-the-scenes stories would make for a steamy beach read. For a while, we worked on a new Broadway video online show called This Is Not a Test. We were all confused when the tech guys explained how, in the future, everyone was going to eventually read articles on their computers. I scoffed at the idea. We spent our afternoons writing comedy and shaking our heads at white supremacist message boards. And after weeks of writing, we watched the first demo, and the slow flashing graphics looked like an old light bright. I was happy when we were eventually fired, because I was convinced this internet thing was a passing fad. This lack of technological foresight is why I am an actor. Comedy Central took notice of us in 1998 due to our manager Dave Becky's persistence and network executive Kent Alterman's vision. We were offered a sketch show, and Upright Citizens Brigade aired on Wednesday nights after another brand new show, South Park. One of us got great ratings. Besser and I broke up, and much to our mutual credit, we handled it smoothly. Matt met and fell in love with his now wife, Danielle Schneider, and UCB went to work writing, producing, and starring in our sketch show. It was all-consuming and totally exhilarating. Under the directorial genius of Phil Morrison, we were allowed to sit in an office, and think of sketch ideas. They would pay us, and we would go to set. We had a set, and it would get on television. My parents could watch it. When UCB premiered on Comedy Central, my parents threw a huge viewing party in their basement. My father got a UCB license plate soon after. The show was based on a long-form improvisational format our mentor Del Close had invented, called The Herald. Scenes were connected, characters lived in different worlds, and most shows were built around a theme. The premise was that a group called the Upright Citizens Brigade worked out of an underground bunker. We rarely used pop culture or parody, except for the always popular Unabomber, Harry Truman, Albert Einstein, and Jesus. RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan once played a neighbor who lived underground next to us and lent the UCB some sugar. The show ran for 3 seasons, and in those few short years, I learned how to be in front of a camera, how to manage an incredibly long workday, and how truly awful it is to wear prosthetics. We asked Dell to record the voiceover for our opening titles.
From the dawn of civilization, they have existed in order to undermine it.
Our only enemy is the status quo.
Our only friend is chaos.
They have no government ties and unlimited resources.
If something goes wrong, we are the cause.
Every corner of this earth is under their surveillance.
If you do it,
we see it.
Always.
We believe the powerful
should be made less powerful.
We have heard the voice of society
begging us to destabilize it.
Antoine.
Colby.
Trotter.
Adair.
We are the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Hardly anyone watched. I wonder why, with that incredibly accessible opening. But it gave us a place to be seen. The show fed the theater, and the theater fed the show. We outgrew solo arts, and we needed our own space, and we found it in the Old Harmony Theater on 22nd Street in Chelsea. The space had been a burlesque house, and after taking it over, we spent days dismantling stages and smashing mirrors. The green room was lined with lockers, and those lockers were filled with old bikinis and Prince mixtapes. I stupidly volunteered to clean the bathrooms, and I pulled out at least a dozen condoms out of the horrible toilets. Even years after we opened in 1999 as a comedy theater, we would get confused men entering in the middle of the day. Well-dressed businessmen and Hasidic shopkeepers would saunter into the lobby, feign interest in the comedy flyers, and then quickly leave. The 22nd Street space became a clubhouse for talented youngsters who are now your favorites. I celebrated the end of the millennium at that theater, saw amazing shows at that theater, fought, cried, and made out at that theater. After 9/11, we all gathered there, grateful that our lives in comedy meant we didn't work in a big building downtown. In 2002, our landlord was cited for a violation and the space was closed down. We panicked and then regrouped, and in the process learned that the theater was not the space, it was the people. We opened our new 150-seat theater a year later and a few blocks away on 26th Street. It was a little fancier, but it was under a Gristiti supermarket, and we had to contend with the sound of shopping carts being dragged and the threat of garbage water bursting through the floor and onto our heads. I continued to write and perform there while I was at SNL. During the big New York blackout in 2003, many of us spent the night sleeping on stage because our generator was working. During the writer's strike in 2007, we put on our own SNL episode there with old sketches. Michael Cera hosted, our musical guest was Yola Tango, and we gave Lorne a birthday cake as he sat in the audience. When I enter the theater and there is a show on stage, it makes me feel safe in the knowledge that the world keeps turning. It also feels like I have died and I'm attending my own funeral, so it's good and bad. Things have steadily moved along since. We opened our first theater in Los Angeles in 2005, the same year we shot a one-hour special for Bravo called ASCAT. It was an attempt to prove improvisation could work on TV, and it featured Tina Andrach and Andy Richter, among others. In 2006, we opened our training center facility in New York, which finally gave us a proper office and classrooms. In 2008, we launched the comedy website ucbcomedy.com. In 2010, we became an accredited theater school. In 2014, we opened a new UCB training center in New York with 14 classrooms and a picnic table and a big new theater space in Los Angeles. At each theater, we produce an average of 4 shows a night and 25 shows a week, all under $10. I will keep bragging. Last year, we sold 400,000 tickets, produced over 4,000 shows, taught over 11,000 students, and employed 216 people. Dell had died in 1999 after a long battle with emphysema. The day before he died, there was a Wiccan ceremony in his hospital room attended by Bill Murray and Harold Ramis. Rest in peace. Dell had drunk a chocolate martini and was gone the next day. Dell always knew when to edit. His famous last words to Sharna were, "I'm tired of being the funniest person in the room." He donated his skull to be used in productions of Hamlet at Chicago's Goodman Theater. Dell filmed a message to the UCB with specific instructions on how to carry on. It was brilliant and touching and not especially lucid. He gave us our motto, "Don't think." In his honor, we started the Dell Close Marathon, an annual 52-hour marathon of improvisation which welcomes groups from all across the country. 15 years later, it now has 56 straight hours of improvisation on 7 stages performed by over 400 different groups. Our free improv show, ASCAT, has now been running for 18 years. My 20 years with the Upright Citizens Brigade could fill a book. Hopefully, someone else will write it, because writing a book is awful, and because most of my memories are drug-fueled and rose-colored. All I know is I will be quick to give photo approval, since I'm very young and skinny in most of the pictures. But I will say this. New York can be a lonely place. I think we stuck together during hard times and provided a home for people to feel less alone. The UCB community is a collaborative and loving group, and it's filled with the funniest people I know. And I'm proud of the fact that Ian and Besser and Walsh and I never made money our motivating factor. We never took a salary. We never charged artists to perform. We never had a 2-drink minimum. Artists could rehearse and perform, and they knew they'd be in front of an audience who spoke their language. This audience could pay very little to see great comedy, never knowing what famous people would show up, but always knowing that some of the people they were watching would one day be famous. UCB's motto is, "Don't think." It started as a directive from Dell, transformed into a comment on corporate doublespeak, and now serves as the guiding principle for our school and theater. Don't think. Get out of your head. Stop planning and just go. The theater belongs to the people. It belongs to Alex Sittis and Susan Hale, who run the spaces and keep the company strong. It belongs to the hundreds of people who have stood on the stage and the many more who have watched shows performed on the stage. It belongs to the students who are waiting to get time on stage and the employees and interns who helped build the stage. Don't think. Just do. We did. Cynthia took off her trench coat and slipped her naked and beautiful body into some sturdy rain boots. Janine reminded her that she didn't need to go through with it if she didn't want to. We all laughed as I produced sparklers I had brought along for the occasion. A man approached us to ask for a light and didn't even react to the naked woman in front of him. New York had already seen it all, but I was just getting started. Everybody lined up to watch and cheer. We were all young and free and wide open. Cynthia walked the city block, and the camera in my mind panned to all the faces of people I loved and respected. It traveled over their heads, up above the trees, dancing on rooftops, and tilting up towards the moon. I had found my tribe. I had helped build a home for us to live in by improvising, making it up as I went along. And now, a poem I wrote about my parents in first grade. Mother is nice. My mother is nice. My father is too. Don't you think so too? I love them so. I wouldn't want them to go. I like them so. Do you think so too? The end. Parents just do understand. Eileen Frances Millmore was born February 7, 1947, in Watertown, Massachusetts. She was the oldest of three children. Her mother, Helen, worked as a secretary at St. Patrick's High School, and her father, Stephen, was a firefighter and World War II veteran. She went to Boston State College and was an excellent student. She met my dad on a school bus on the way to a basketball game. She was head cheerleader, and he was the best player on the team. She tapped him on the head and asked to sit with him. She was 23 when she got married, 24 when I was born, and 41 when she got her master's degree in special education. She taught for 31 years, starting in elementary and ending in high school special ed. One of her most exciting moments was sharing an elevator with Sally Field. During a recent trip to Amsterdam, she sent me a picture of her smoking marijuana for the first time, just because I asked her to. She is kind, she is chatty, and she writes beautiful poetry. William Grinstead Poehler was born September 21, 1946, in Waynesboro, Virginia. His mother, Anna, was first married to William, his father, who left right after he was born. For the first 5 years of his life, my father lived in a foster home. Anna remarried, and her new husband, Carl Poehler, adopted my father and his sister and moved them all to Massachusetts. Anna and Carl had two more sons. The first day my father met my mother, he came home and told my grandmother, "I've met the girl I'm going to marry." He was an elementary school teacher and also a financial planner. One of his most exciting moments was sharing an elevator with Boston Celtics Robert Parrish and Kevin McHale. For my wedding, my father, his friends, and my uncles performed a surprise tap dance number with top hats and canes. He is generous, nosy, and good in arm wrestling. They have been married 45 years. Here are some things they taught me. You know what? I'll let them tell you. Guys, Mom, Dad, you're up.
Mom, make sure he's grateful to be with you. Your boobs won't be as big as mine, but you'll be happy about that as you get older. Always tell people when they do a good job. Always have a messy purse. Guilt works. You are the smartest and best. Monty Python is funny. Be nice to your brother. Be a light sleeper, and every time your kid wakes you up, scream like you are being attacked. Have fun dancing. Have male friends. Have more female friends. Your female friends will outlast every man in your life. Love your husband and don't belittle him. Love your kids and hope they do better than you did. You don't want to be the sexy mom. Dye your hair constantly. There's not much we can do about our Irish eyebrows. Postpartum depression, anxiety, and skin cancer run in our family. Ask your kids how they are doing, but sometimes ignore them when they say, not great. Love your work. Study hard and know how to write and read well. Memorize poems. Be nice to teachers. Teachers don't like kids who don't like teachers. Always bring wine. A home-cooked meal isn't so important. TV in your bedroom is okay. Follow sports and leave the room if you're a jinx. Be careful. You got those, Amy?
Amy, this is your father. Ask for what you want. Know how to shoot a free throw and field a ground ball. There are ways around things that aren't always legal. Hide cash in your house. Always overtip, but make a big deal out of paying the check. Eat whatever you want. Keep trying. Never remember anyone's name. Girls can do anything boys can do. Street smarts are as important as book smarts. Your mother is smarter than me, and I'm fine with it. Don't work too hard. You can have a chaotic childhood and still provide a stable home. Ask everyone how much money they make. Keep the TV loud and all the lights on in the house. You don't want to be the creepy dad. It's okay to cry. It's okay to argue. Tell everyone you meet what your daughter does until your daughter asks you to stop. Our family has a history of bad stomachs, heart problems, and loss of hearing we will deny. Don't hit your kids, except that one time. Love your wife's family. Don't listen to experts. Everything in moderation.
Thanks, Dad. Don't forget to tip your waitresses. The town where I grew up was decidedly blue-collar, filled with teachers and nurses and the occasional sales manager. My friends and I fell asleep to the sound of our parents arguing about car payments and tuition. It was our soundtrack, this din of worry. If you were old enough, you were expected to have a part-time job. When I was 16, I got one. I was a junior secretary in a podiatrist's office near my house in Burlington. I had to wear a short white skirt, a tight blouse, and high-heeled shoes. This outfit made me look like a teenage nurse, which sounds hot, but I promise you was not. I was a teenager during a period of truly awful style. It made sense that my friends and I all had part-time jobs because we dressed like Melanie Griffith and Working Girl during a long subway commute. Hairspray was king, and the 80s silhouette in Burlington was big hair, giant shoulder pads, chunky earrings, thick belts, and form-fitting stretch pants. My silhouette was an upside-down triangle. Add in my round potato face and hearty eyebrows, and you've got yourself a grade-A boner killer. So remember that before you try to jerk it to my teenage nurse story. Anyway, this other nurse and I used to jump around in our underwear and kiss each other for fun. Oh, wait, what I meant to say was I answered phones and filed things. The best part of my job was leaning into the waiting room and whispering, "The doctor will see you now." It always felt like such a waspy phrase, right up there with, "It truly is my pleasure," and, "We just got back from the country." Every once in a while, we would get an exciting sprained ankle or a flat feet emergency, but usually the patients were just old people who couldn't cut their own toenails anymore. I was a really good waitress. Waitressing takes a certain gusto. You need a good memory and an ability to connect with people fast. You have to learn how to treat the kitchen as well as you treat the customers. You have to figure out which crazy people to listen to and which crazy people to ignore. I loved waiting tables because when you cashed out at the end of the night, your job was truly over. You wiped down your section and paid out your busboy, and you knew your work was done. I didn't take my job home with me, except, you know, for the occasional nightmare where I would wake up in a cold sweat and remember I had never brought Table 14 or Diet Coke. My first waitressing job was in the summer of 1989, a few months before I left for college. I was 17 and sticky. I earned the extra money I needed for textbooks scooping ice cream at Chadwick's, a local parlor that specialized in sundaes and giant steak fries. Chadwick's was in Lexington, Massachusetts, the rich town next door, the Eagleton to our Pawnee. Lexington was the famous home of the shot heard round the world. Burlington was the home of the mall. Lexington, as it turns out, is also Rachel Dratch's hometown, and much later I would learn that she also worked at the same sticky emporium a few years before I did. Imagine if our paths had crossed. Imagine how hilarious we would have been while we shoved toothpicks in the club sandwiches. Think of all the jokes about marrying the ketchups. Ugh, such a waste. Lexington High still plays Burlington High on Thanksgiving Day, and Dratch and I trash text each other. She calls me Burlington garbage, and I tell her to go drive her Mercedes into a lake. In my town, the best way to insult someone was to call them rich and smart, which, looking back, was maybe a little short-sighted of us. You know what? Who cares? Burlington rules. Go Red Devils! Summer jobs are often romantic. The time frame creates a perfect parenthesis. Chadwick's was not. Hard and physical, The job consisted of stacking and wiping and scooping and lifting. At the end of my shift, every removable piece of the restaurant would be carted off and washed. Vinyl booths were searched and scrubbed. This routine seemed Sisyphean at first, but I soon learned the satisfaction of working at a place that truly closed. I took great joy in watching people stroll in after hours, thinking they could grab a late-night sundae. I would point to the dim lights and the stacked chairs as proof that we were shut. It was deliciously obvious and final. Chadwick's was one of those fake old-timey restaurants. The menus were written in swoopy cursive. The staff wore styrofoam boaters and ruffled white shirts with bow ties. Jangly music blared from a player piano as children climbed on counters. If the style of the restaurant was old-fashioned, the parenting that went on there was distinctly modern. Moms and dads would patiently recite every item on the menu to their squirming 5-year-olds, as if the many flavors of ice cream represented all the unique ways they were loved. There was a performance element to the job that I found appealing. Every time a customer was celebrating a birthday, an employee had to bang a drum that hung from the ceiling and play the kazoo and encourage the entire restaurant to join him or her in a sing-along. Other employees would ring cowbells and blow noisemakers. I would stand on a chair and loudly announce, "Ladies and gentlemen, we're so happy to have you at Chadwick's today, but we're especially happy to have Kevin, because it's Kevin's birthday today. So, at the sound of the drum, please join me in singing Kevin a very happy birthday." The appeal didn't last long. I'm not sure when the worm turned. Maybe it was during one of the many times we announced the Belly Buster. The Belly Buster consisted of mounds of ice cream in a giant silver bowl carried in on a stretcher. The busboys would have to pretend to struggle under the weight of this giant sundae as they lifted it onto the table and handed a giant spoon to the maniac who had ordered it. I would ease my pain by exchanging looks with one busboy who was always slightly drunk and the ex-junkie cook who was always slightly grouchy. The cook spoke in bumper stickers when describing his disposition. "Of course I'm mean. It's hard to be happy when you're standing this close to the fire." But the teenagers were the worst, teenage boys especially. They would file in, Adam's apples bouncing, and announce it was their birthdays. And since Chadwick's operated on an honor system, I would have to look into their sweaty, lying faces and smile like a flight attendant. Some of them would order their sundaes while asking me to hold their nuts. I was relieved when I had to leave and head to college. It was time. Besides, I had started forgetting to charge for whipped cream. I was failing to use the ice scoop. A customer told me I was banging the drum too hard. She was right. I was angry. I wanted to be gone. It's important to know when it's time to turn in your kazoo. The nights would end with the waitstaff in the parking lot, sitting on a car and drinking beer as we counted our tips. The boys would undo their bow ties and suddenly look weary and handsome. I would change into soft jeans and throw pennies at the dumpster. I was aching for what came next. I felt my whole life stretched out before me like an invisible buffet. I learned many things banging that drum at Chadwick's. I learned that a good tip is what a decent person leaves. I learned that how a person treats their waitress is a great indication of their character. I learned that chocolate chip ice cream is a bitch to scoop. I learned almost all the people in a working kitchen are having sex with each other, except for the Bangladeshi busboys who are supporting 3 kids back home and trying not to strangle the awful white teenagers complaining about their summer job. My next restaurant job was in Boston during college at a place called Paparazzi. I was immediately drawn to it because it was a step up from ice cream and also because I love the Paparazzi. I don't care what anyone says. I think the Paparazzi are awesome and they're all great people and I should be allowed to see pictures of anyone I want anytime. Paparazzi introduced me to the world of breadsticks and olive oil. We wore all white like professionals and talked about cavatappi pasta. I had an affair with the bartender and attended wine tastings. I had great abs and I listened to the as we cleaned up. I knew the bartender was fucking someone else at the same time, and I didn't care. I felt very adult. At Paparazzi, I learned that I was actually a great waitress and it was easy money, and everyone was doing cocaine, and that maybe I actually did care about the bartender fucking someone else. Carlucci was a joint in Chicago, and my first foray into the big leagues. My uniform was a smart burgundy vest and floral tie. I looked like a serious waitress who was also capable of performing some light magic. Fine Italian dining was hitting its peak, and Carlucci was a way for upper-middle-class people to spend their Wall Street money. This place was no ice cream joint. It catered to businessmen with fat ties and fatter wallets. We had banquet halls and mise en place. We had a mean Italian chef who gave seminars on homemade grappa. I opened my first bottle of $200 wine. I catered an off-site party for Darcy from the Smashing Pumpkins and smoked with James Iha. Billy Corgan sang in Darcy's living room, and I listened from a closet. Once, I heard a familiar voice in the restaurant, and I turned to see Oprah at a table with what looked like a gaggle of producers. And if my memory serves me correctly, she was giving them presents. I feel like it was diamond earrings. I want that to be true. I feel like Oprah pays all of her employees in diamonds and cashmere pajamas. While I was at Carlucci, I learned how to dust a tiramisu and pair cordials. I learned having a pocket filled with cash is a dangerous thing. I learned that I was getting way too good at a job that was not my life's passion, and I learned that I was the only one not doing cocaine. My last big gig was at a real classy joint called Aqua Grill in New York City. It was 1996, and I had just moved to New York. I wanted a job, so I walked around Soho looking for help wanted signs in the windows. I was called a server by then, and I knew how to navigate the fancier places. I walked into Aqua Grill and began my experience of trying to help a new restaurant get off the ground. The owners were talented and lovely, but I felt like an imposter in all of our pre-opening meetings. I wanted to earn a living as an actor, and I wanted to pay off my student loans and maybe get some health insurance. It would be a long time before those things happened, but they felt close enough to see. Aqua Grill is a beautiful little place with yellow walls and fresh seafood. I finally learned how to save a little money. I learned how to tell the difference between East Coast and West Coast oysters. I waited on people like Ellen Barkin and David Byrne and Lou Reed. I was getting closer to Lou Reed, one step at a time. I waited on restaurant critic Ruth Reichel. She would come in wearing wigs and using a pseudonym. The restaurant got a great review, and she said this. In New York City, home of the fabulous, the chic, the loud, and the exotic, a nice restaurant is a rare thing. So rare that when I encountered the pleasant staff at Aqua Grill, I was acutely uncomfortable. Don't those people ever stop smiling? She was uncomfortable with my smiling. I didn't care. I had made the New York Times. The restaurant opened, and I left soon after, praying that my bi-monthly Conan appearances and piecemeal Comedy Central gigs would sustain me. I was out of the restaurant business, but I still had my appetite. I turned toward my future, mouth-watering.
Other people are not medicine.
Treat your career like a bad boyfriend. Once, I was sleeping on an Amtrak train to New York and was startled by a thud. Someone had dumped a script into my lap as they prepared to get off the train. I woke to a kind-faced businessman smiling at me apologetically. He looked at me like we were friends. I was immediately enraged. The script was for a movie called I Don't Know, Because I Threw It Away. I was angry for a few reasons. I don't like it when people wake me up. Being a bad sleeper, I have a hard time opening my eyes. I am amazed at people who wake up and talk like normal humans. These are the same people who don't thrash around when they sleep and have never been told that they snore like a dragon. I was also angry because I don't like to be solicited. My years of living in New York City have made me very sensitive to the random encounter. When I walk down the street and someone asks me, excuse me, can I ask you a question? I immediately put my hand up and firmly say, no. No one needs to ask me a question. There is no reason to talk to strangers. I don't want you to hand me your homemade CD or talk to me on an airplane or try to upsell me on drink specials. As I get older, I get a real pleasure from maintaining boundaries with strangers. I have come to enjoy telling the cheese guy at the farmer's market that he does not value my time. I like letting my massage therapist know that she's putting her needs before my own. It may be difficult to tell my family I feel pressure to entertain them, but it's easy to tell the UPS guy that he needs to respect my personal space. When someone randomly hands me a script, it means I have already disappointed them. I don't like disappointing people. Some would say this is codependent behavior, which I have discovered is a term that explains how most everyone acts all of the time unless one is a sociopath or a Russian computer that plays chess. Plus, when someone hands me a script, it only reminds me of how I should write more scripts and get my shit together and stop sleeping on trains. And I don't care that you add an attached note that says, "My wife and I are lawyers by day, but screenwriters by night, and we think you could act in / produce / direct / rewrite this with us." I'm not impressed when you assure me that the story has lots of twists and turns. I doubt it does, and how dare you? See? I'm not as nice as you think I am. Being a working actor whom people recognize sometimes means you occasionally get the young up-and-comer who thinks that meeting you is their chance to break in. The good version of this meeting is when someone tells you they are inspired by you and hoping to follow in your footsteps. This makes your heart warm, and it also gives you just enough of an inflated sense of self to justify eating an entire bag of Doritos later that evening and eventually falling asleep with your hands down your pants. The bad version of this meeting is when someone hands you something or asks you to do something for them or announces loudly that you better remember their name because they're going to be famous one day. Good or bad, the reality is most people become famous or get great jobs after a very, very long tenure shoveling shit, and not because they handed their script to someone on the street. People still think they'll be discovered in the malt shop, even though no one can tell you what a malt is anymore. Everyone wants to believe that they will be the regular guy from Sioux City who becomes a reluctant movie star despite his best attempts to remain a sensitive tattoo artist. People don't want to hear about the 15 years of waiting tables and doing small shows with your friends until one of them gets a little more famous and they convince people to hire you, and then you get paid and you work hard and spend time getting better and making more connections and friends. Boring. It's much more interesting to believe that every person who makes it in show business just wrote a check to their mother when they were 18 for $1 million with an instruction to cash in a year. I was never great in auditions. When I was nervous, I would often underprepare and act too cool for school. I would try to reject them before they rejected me, which was confusing since I had decided to audition and acted angry to be there. I remember one particular time I auditioned for a Coen Brothers film. I realized I was doing a pretty shitty job, and I overcompensated by also acting like a dick. The Coen Brothers were very nice, I think. I've blocked it all out. It took me a while to step out of my comfort zone and put my neck out to audition for something. College was filled with small parts in big musical productions. What's Her Name in Brigadoon, Who's Her Face in Midsummer Night's Dream, That Lady in That Other Play. All small and usually comical, all satisfying in their low level of risk. I surfed in a very cool and confident zone, and my ego was snugly and warm in a sleeping bag of safe choices. Then I moved to Chicago, and the shit hit the fan. I started going on cold auditions, the kind where your agent sends you in and you have no idea why. The worst auditions were what we called bite and smiles. This is when you go in for a Wendy's spot and you just have to pretend to eat something and smile. No words, just the simple fact of presenting your face to the camera and hoping someone likes it. I had the presence of mind even then to know that I would never book one of these. One, my teeth were kind of jacked up, and that never bodes well in close-ups. And two, I don't have symmetrical good looks, and therefore I like to think that my personality is my currency. I remember a Chicago casting director asking me to pretend to bite into something and then smile. I did my best, and I was about to leave when the casting director asked me to stay and put something on tape. I got excited. Maybe she saw potential in me. Maybe I would finally get to play the blue-collar white girl arsonist on my favorite show of all time, Law & Order. Instead, she asked me to sit on a stool and tell her my most embarrassing moment. I asked why. She said she just wanted to have some tape of me talking. I asked her if I could talk about something else, and she shook her head and said, "Tell me your most embarrassing moment." And I said, "No." And she never called me again. Quick note here. Everybody wants you to share your most embarrassing moment all the time, and I am here to tell you that you don't have to. You don't have to tell it or tweet it or Instagram it. You don't have to put it in a book or share it with anyone who doesn't feel safe and protective of your heart. More cold auditions followed, and none amounted to much. Almost every job I've ever gotten was due to someone knowing my work or seeing me in something else. I was in UCB, and Andy Richter suggested I do stuff for Conan. Being on Conan helped me land a part in Deuce Bigelow. My UCB television show and friends helped me get an audition for SNL. My SNL connections resulted in Parks and Recreation. See? Years and years of hard work and little bits of progress isn't nearly as entertaining as imagining me telling a joke in a Boston food court when suddenly Lorne Michaels walks up and says, "I must have you for a little show I do." I once was having dinner with my old friend back when I was on SNL. Baby Mama was coming out, and I was in the middle of one of those weird press pushes where your face is on taxis and you're doing talk shows all the time. My friend, who was as funny and talented as me but chose not to be an actor, was talking about how he was seeing my face everywhere. He went on and on about how weird that was. He pointed out that people were really starting to know my name and asked me if I could believe it. "Yes," I said. I had worked for over a decade to get to this moment. I hadn't just dropped my script into someone's lap on a train. "Can you?" I asked him. But I was lucky. Your career and your passion don't always match up. Plenty of talented people don't have the careers they want. Plenty of untalented people make millions and make movies. There's a difference between determination and talent. Hard work doesn't always matter. You can be the best at making contacts and going after jobs, but then suddenly you want it too much. Suddenly everybody feels how bad you want it, and they don't want to give it to you. Even at 6 years old, Archie is learning to stop paying attention to the toy he wants. He knows that if he lets on how bad he wants it, his 4-year-old brother will snatch that shiz up in a hot second. Pretending to not want something can work. Really not caring if you get it takes a lifetime of practice. I guess the Buddhists would call this idea healthy detachment. Too often, we are told to visualize what we want and cut out pictures of it and repeat it like a mantra over and over again. Books and magazines tell us to create vision boards. Late-night commercials remind us that anything is possible. Positive affirmations are written on our tea bags. I'm introducing a new idea. Try to care less. Practice ambivalence. Learn to let go of wanting it. Treat your career like a bad boyfriend. Here's the thing. Your career won't take care of you. It won't call you back or introduce you to its parents. Your career will openly flirt with other people while you are around. It will forget your birthday and wreck your car. Your career will blow you off if you call it too much. It's never going to leave its wife. Your career is fucking other people and everyone knows but you. Your career will never marry you. Now, before I extend this metaphor, let me make a distinction between career and creativity. Creativity is connected to your passion, the light inside you that drives you, that joy that comes when you do something you love, that small voice that tells you, "I like this. Do this again. You are good at it. Keep going." This is the juicy stuff that lubricates our lives and helps us feel less alone in the world. Your creativity is not a bad boyfriend. It's a really warm, older Hispanic lady who has a beautiful laugh and loves to hug. And if you are even a little bit nice to her, she will make you feel great and maybe cook you delicious food. Career is different. Career is the stringing together of opportunities and jobs. Mix in public opinion and past regrets. Add a dash of future panic and a whole lot of financial uncertainty. Career is something that fools you into thinking you are in control and then takes pleasure in reminding you that you aren't. Career is the thing that will not fill you up and never make you truly whole. Depending on your career is like eating cake for breakfast and wondering why you start crying an hour later. I was on a panel once with the genius writer David Simon. I think The Wire is the best written show in recent memory. I've watched every episode of all 5 seasons twice. For Mother's Day 1 year, Aziz Ansari got me a signed and framed picture of Omar Little with the inscription, "Amy, you come at the king, you best not miss, Omar." Next to my children and my blood diamonds, this is the only thing I would grab in a fire. A nice young person stood up at the panel and asked David and me how we found the courage to do what we do. We both bristled a bit at the idea of our work being courageous. We both admitted that we often think about how if everything went away tomorrow, we would still have a trade and a skill to depend on. He could go back to reporting, a career he started in, and I could go teach improvisation at the UCB Theater or choreograph dance for child pageants, a path I am interested in pursuing at a later date. Either way, we both agreed that ambivalence is key to success. I will say it again. Ambivalence is key. You have to care about your work, but not about the result. You have to care about how good you are and how good you feel, but not about how good people think you are or how good people think you look. I realize this is extremely difficult. I'm not saying I'm particularly good at it. I'm like you, or maybe you're better at this than I am. You will never